Access number 31464, Mr. Dennis Goodrich, Reel 2. Now, we're talking about this course you did on the gyroscopic bomb sight, the Mark 14. But just to take, I mean, I understand what you've told me so far, but can you just explain for them what a gyroscopic, what the gyroscope part is and how it works in a bomb sight? I can't quite get it to...
You know, have you said you had a toy? Did you have a toy when you were a youngster? Well, you know, the wheel goes round and round. But if the wheel stops, the gyroscope topples over. And once it topples over, everything goes out. So you had to keep that wheel going, come what may, in a gyroscope. Because once it toppled, you could never get it back on again. It would sometimes take an hour to get that wheel to turn again, to get it back. So nothing worked.
So how does a gyroscope make a bomb sight work? If you see what, that might be too technical for you to explain.
It's very technical.
I don't quite understand what it's got to do with. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it operated the lenses in the sight to keep the lenses onto your target. If you didn't have it, you couldn't do it by hand. You couldn't hold it by hand. It wouldn't do, especially in an aircraft, with all the vibration. So the gyroscope was supposed to stop all the vibration, keep everything actually smooth. That's what it was for.
So, were there any other problems other than the gyroscope falling over that might happen with a bomb sight?
Not really, no. That was the main thing. If that went west, you were finished. You couldn't do anything, especially if you were in the air and you couldn't get it operating again. So you had to make, I had to make sure before they went that it was okay.
Did they go often?
Quite a lot, yeah.
We'll talk about that a bit more when we, you know. Now you had a course in something else as well. The
automatic pilot. They called it George. It's known as George. All through the aircraft trade, it's known. It still is known as George, the automatic pilot.
Do you know why that is?
I couldn't tell you. I think it was because the first chap that invented it was an American named George. But they still use that name for modern aircraft in George. They still use it.
Now, so how does the automatic pilot work? Well, tell me a bit about that.
That works again on vacuum and on gyroscopes. When you're up in a certain, you have to get to a certain height, and then you switch on the automatic pilot. It takes over the controls. You can't control it. And if you use special force, you have to override it if you use special force. But if it's, you set your course you want to take on the dials, and then the gyroscope will go, the automatic will go that way it said. That you set it on, that will go until you change it. And you change it by turning a little knob, that alters the gyroscope once again, and the aircraft either veers to the left or the right, or up and down, whichever way you want it to go.
So does this in fact come down to the same thing? You're going to have to make sure that gyroscope's
going? Of course, you've got to make sure it's all going.
And were there any other problems that might arise?
No, I don't really know.
So again, it's really, is it working or not?
That's right, that's all it was. And you must remember, these aircraft were going into battle, and once they were damaged, that's why a lot of them didn't get back, because their instruments weren't working. They were damaged.
Now, were there any other instruments that you worked on that you recall, or those two the main ones?
Well, there's one thing on an aircraft in those days called the blind flying panel, and that was fitted on every aircraft. It's six instruments on it.
Is that the thing that's the same on every aircraft?
Every aircraft. It's right. On even today, it's still on there.
Now tell me about it.
It's got an altimeter, an automatic compass, a turn and bank indicator. What else has it got? I can't think of other things now. I can't remember them all.
Horizon one.
Yeah, the artificial horizon. That's the main thing, the artificial horizon. And
there's a couple more, but
you've got those, you could fly anywhere if they were working. And once again, they worked on vacuum. All those worked on air vacuum. Oh, well, airspeed indicator, the other one.
I think that is the six. So,
have you seen on a modern aircraft a thing that sticks out the front? On all of them, you've got it on modern. It's like a tube that sticks out the front. That is the thing that operates the airspeed indicator. And it doesn't operate with the wind coming in. It operates with the vacuum. It causes vacuum when it goes past, and that operates all your instruments inside.
Now, so again, you're just learning how to make sure they're all working.
That's right, yeah.
Is there any what would you do if one wasn't? Would you just replace it?
Oh, if you replace most of it, yes.
You wouldn't repair.
It wasn't fair to repair. It wasn't safe to repair them. You had to replace them.
Would you replace the whole panel?
The whole lot. Not the panel, not instrument panel, no. If one of the instruments, you could replace an instrument, yes. But there again, when you see an instrument, the thing itself is on the panel, but the thing is operated by a long tube. maybe 50 feet long that operates, and that's off. You have to hold, put the instrument in, and then you have to wind that thing right through the aircraft to get it back to where it should go. That's all. That's what operates those instruments mainly, and that still applies today.
Anything else? Any other instruments you had to deal with?
No, that's all.
Because we'll come back to a bit more about. So, how many were on the course at Cranwell?
I think there were about 20 of us in the course there.
And what was the pass or failure rate? Or was it everyone
passed? Everyone passed. They made sure you passed. They said they couldn't afford a failure. They wouldn't afford it.
How difficult was the course? I mean, for you?
Extremely difficult. They said, when you pass out, you'll only pass out as an aircraft aircraftman second class. We can't give you any more because you get promotion when you've done the job, which was true.
They couldn't have given you any less, either.
Oh, no,
that's
they
the
couldn't
lowest
have,
rank.
Well, they could, because there was, oh, yes, in the aircraft, the lowest rank was aircraft hand, which was, he did nothing except so he was worked in the galleys or something like that. No, he didn't work on any aircraft.
So, would you have to SWAT in the evenings, or, I mean...
Oh, yes, yeah.
And what were the, was it done by lectures or practical? How did they actually teach
lectures.
You?
Lectures. Mostly lectures, and then you had the written exams and things to do as well.
Were they on a regular basis?
At the end of every week you have an exam on what you've done the week previously.
Did that leave much time for recreation?
None at all.
Were they teaching you anything else while you were there?
Not at Cranwell, no.
So how long were you at Cranwell for?
Oh, maybe.
Roughly. April 40 to...
I think about...
it might have been May 40, but...
About 10 weeks, I think. I'm not sure.
So through till about... September or August?
Well, no, it was I think it was not so short. It must have been shorter than that because it had been about, early August, probably early August.
So while the Battle of Britain was on?
Yes.
Now, you passed out as an aircraftman second class.
Yes.
Was there a passing out parade?
Yes, yeah.
What do you remember of that? Was it a big thing or was it?
No, it was just shake hands and away you go because they'd already got you posting to where you were going.
Now, where were you posted to?
Now, that's the point. They posted me, first of all, to a place called Detling in Kent. When I got there, they said, we don't want you. We haven't got any bomb sites. You're in the wrong place. You should have gone somewhere else. But meanwhile, they said, but you can stay here for a couple of days. The Battle of Britain was on. So they sent me to Manston, right in the middle of the Battle of Britain, refueling Spitfires and Hurricanes, which I didn't know anything about. But looking after, if their instruments went wrong, I was to tell them what was wrong, that was all. That was for 2 days. Then they say, your posting's coming through, you're going to Linton-on-Ouse in Yorkshire.
Tell me a bit about refuelling Spitfires and Hurricanes. Did you actually have to help?
Yes.
So how did you do it?
Well, they call petrol bows, as used to come along. They're great, big, like our tankers, only a lot smaller, and they used to fill them up with that. And also, one thing I must mention, for some unknown reason, the instrument maker is always responsible for the oxygen bottles in an aircraft. Now, every aircraft, if it flies over 15,000 feet, you must use oxygen in the Air Force. So I was responsible for those that were. So when Spitfire came into land, if I was there, I'd have to change the oxygen bottles.
What does that involve?
Not too much. It's just to lift it out and be careful. Don't drop it on the ground if it's on a hard concrete.
Why not? Would it explode?
It could explode if it went at a sudden jolt.
And was there anything happening? I mean, you'd gone to Detling and they moved you on to Manston. That's where you did the actual work, is it?
Yeah, only for a couple of days at Manston.
And
then
what? Anything happened? I mean, they were attacking you.
Oh yeah, we were being attacked while we were doing that.
Now tell me about that.
We're being strafed by the Luftwaffe.
Tell us about that. Because people don't know what that's
like.
Well,
you'd be an air raid sign, but you weren't allowed to leave the aircraft. You had to stay by the aircraft. They had a slit trench by the side of the aircraft. You got into that and waited, you know, until it was all clear, and got out and get on with the job then when it came out.
Any close shaves, or were you lucky?
Not really, no. I was lucky, I suppose.
Were you nervous at all? It's your first time under fire, isn't it?
You didn't have the time to be nervous, to be perfectly honest. You didn't have to think about it. You just have time to think about anything, about what you except what you were supposed to do, that was all.
Was it very quick, the raids?
Oh, yes, just only a few seconds, really, just come over and away again, you know.
There were German fighters.
Oh, yeah, Luftwaffe, and Italians.
anything else? Any casualties during the raids?
I don't remember any of myself, of my people, no.
Not around you, anyway. No. Anything else happened at Detlein or Manson?
No, not much. I was waiting to get away from there because I wasn't supposed to be there.
And that was in August?
Yeah.
And then you went to Linton-on-Ouse,
yes.
And do you know which base, who were you attached to?
58th Squadron.
And were you part of 58th Squadron?
Yes, I was part of 58th Squadron then.
And what was your, you know, you arrive at a place like that. You're new. How did they meet you when you arrived at the base?
Well, I didn't get there till the middle of the night, so and I couldn't. They dropped me off the station at York, and I couldn't find where Linton-on-Ouse was from York. So I stopped a local bus driver, and he told me where it gets to. So they sent a taxi, van out to pick me up and took me back to the station.
And what happened when you got there?
Oh, they just said, come in, we'll find your bed for the night, and so that's all they did for that night.
And did they introduce you to the squad? Or did they tell you what's going on? Well, you know, is there a sort of proper procedure?
Oh, yes, yeah, tell you what you're going to do, and that's on where your billets were, how you were going to be looked after, and what you had to, and what section you're going to belong. In the Air Force, they have sections. The sections was the instrument section that I was in, and that was a special part in the hangar.
So you were the instrument section?
That's right.
And you were an aircraft and second class instrument maker?
Yeah, that's right.
And was everyone friendly?
Oh, yes. I was made an aircraft from first class pretty well straight away as soon as I got there. So then you up and
so that happened almost?
Almost as soon as I got there. So we can't have a second class man looking after aircraft.
Now, so tell me what a typical day's work would be like at Linton-on-Ouse.
Well, it'd be after reveille in the morning, breakfast, and then down to
can we just talk about food in the RAF generally? I mean, I didn't mention it earlier. What was the food like?
I thought it was very good, actually. I never had any real problems with it at all.
Was there enough of it?
Oh, plenty, yes. No.
And the quality was
alright? The quality was always good, yes.
Enough variety?
I think so, yes.
So you had no.
For civilians weren't getting much anyway, so why should we complain? It was all right.
So no complaints.
No complaints.
So after breakfast, your day, how would it start?
You'd go down to the hangar where the instrument section was and start to find out what's happened during the night, because the bombers were coming back at night, and anything wrong, we had to sort it out, you know, if they all got back.
So the bomber would come in.
Yeah. By the way, they were Whitley bombers. That was a very important part.
Now tell me how you do a check. I know you are an instrument maker. You've got to check their instrument.
That's right.
How would you go about checking?
Well, you get the fitter to come out and run all the engines up for you and see that all the instruments were working on the engine and things like that. And you have to work with him and with the armourers and the people like that to see all the instruments were okay. But there's one thing I must tell you. I was working. I had to go on working on a Whitley, and I had to do something underneath with the oxygen. I was lying up on the ground floor, underneath the aircraft, and the armourers hadn't fitted the bomb in properly, and a 250-pound dropped on my foot. But they all ran away. It wouldn't have gone off because it wasn't armed. Because it wasn't armed until it was in the air, but it landed on my foot. And I still got the bad toe today, these days through that bad toe.
I mean, did it break it? Or?
No, it didn't break it, but it smashed my toenail up.
So you were to check. So what would you check? You go on board the Whitley. How do you start? I presume there's a routine, usually, isn't there?
Yeah, well, you have to go through.
How would you start?
Well, they start with the engine instruments first to see they're all working. Then you'd have to go on a test flight. The pilot would take you up on a test flight to see all the other aircraft, the other instruments were working. Like
so you'd go up with it?
Oh, yes.
Was that your first flight?
That was the first flight then. No, I had a first flight at Cranwell, actually, but that was the first. But talking about the first flight, they were short of air gunners. And they said, as you've got a bit of experience of flying with the instruments, we're going to make you an air gunner for a couple of trips. They put me in the back seat, back of a Whitley, gave me a...
I will definitely come back to that, don't worry. Let's just look at this typical test first, keep it all together, and then we'll come... So, you'd check the instrument, sorry, check the engine instrument, then you'd go for a test flight.
Yeah.
And how do you check? I mean, do you just look at them?
Well, the pilot would tell you what was wrong. If he knows everything wasn't working properly, let you know. And that's all, really. Well, if he was like, if he cleared it and the aircraft fitters, the engine fitters cleared it, then you're okay.
So you wouldn't check, you wouldn't open it up and check anything unless it was wrong.
And there is a thing in the Air Force called the Form 700.
Tell me about that.
That is a form that has to be filled in by all the people who've worked on the aircraft, including the air crew, before it's allowed to fly again. If you don't, you can't take off and you have that thing haven't been sorted out, that Form 700, and that still applies today. I still got it on the Air Force today. Yeah.
And that just covers everything?
It covers everything on the aircraft. If one of those things isn't working and it's not filled in on the form, the pilot can't take it off.
So you wouldn't open up, basically your part was, the pilot would take it for a test flight and he'd say that's not working.
That's
and
right.
Then when he got on the ground, you'd try and fix it.
If I couldn't get it, go to the stores and see if they got one. And then
of course you wouldn't repair it.
Oh no, you can't repair them. There's no way you can't repair those instruments at all. And though they call it makers and repairers, you couldn't repair them. You have to fit new ones.
Always. But then you had to get the, when you fitted a new instrument, you had to get the gyroscope going.
Yes, that's right, get it all going again.
And the reason you wouldn't open up or check anything that the pilot didn't draw your attention.
Oh, no, no.
Because you might knock the gyroscope off.
No. The only thing is you must check the oxygen was working. That was part of my job. You turned on the taps and see the oxygen was working.
And that was as far as you go.
That's it, yeah.
Anything else that was done, on the Whitleys?
Not very much, no. Though, of course, they weren't very good aircraft.
Tell me what was wrong. What was wrong with the Whitley, in your opinion?
They were underpowered and too slow. They only had two engines. And they were underpowered. And they used to fly on what was called a nose down. They used to fly like that, nose down all the time. So the instrument suddenly wouldn't work properly when level flight. But that was a design fault. The Armstrong Whitley was the design fault.
And what about inside? Were they roomy or cramped?
No, very cramped, very cramped.
How many was the crew?
Pilot, co-pilot, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. Six. Pilot and second pilot, radio operator, 3 air gunners. 1 in the front, 1 in the back and 1 in the middle.
Now, tell me then about, you actually went on these trips.
Well, they said we were short of an air gunners and they hadn't got the crew coming through. As you've had a bit of experience in flying, you'd have to do a couple of trips. So they said, course on air gunnery, which I didn't know much about. And they put me in the back seat, in the back turret of a Whitley.
That's as rear gunner then?
As rear gunner. But below it, we weren't...
Tell me about the course first you went on.
Hardly anything.
what guns were you using them?
For 303s, Browning
V303s. And what were the Browning V303s like to use?
They weren't very good. They were not good enough, really, for the job, really and truly.
Why not?
They weren't powerful enough. That's why the Americans went for bigger ones when they started.
And how did you fire them? I mean,
just press button.
Was it all four?
You had a steering handlebar to steer the turret round and around, and you on those handles you had buttons. You pressed the buttons and the guns fired.
All at once.
All four at once. Yeah.
So, can you describe the rear turret for me a bit more? So you've got this handlebar.
Yeah.
Thing,
you get.
And is it your strength moving it, or?
You have to move it by your hands. Yeah.
It's not powered?
No, not powered, no.
Was that difficult? Or?
No, not more. It was all on bearings. It all turned quite easily, actually.
So, and the up and down, how did you do that?
Just turn those up and down.
That's all it was? So you twist like a motorcycle?
Like a motorcycle, yeah.
So, now tell me about the raids. How many raids did you go on?
I only went on two. But
do you remember them both?
Yes, I remember.
Well, take me through the first raid.
Before we start, I would say that they weren't really raids because we didn't have any bombs. We would drop leaflets.
Oh, no, well, that's still, still get killed doing that.
No, there was no, what in the early part of the war, there was no opposition hardly. We went once over Berlin and once over Cologne and dropped.
So
that's my two.
And what was a typical, tell me about the raid then. What about the first one was Berlin, was it?
Berlin, yes.
Now, how did you get briefed? I mean, when did you first know you were going on it?
Well, they told us we were going to Berlin, but we wouldn't have any bombs because we weren't allowed to bomb Berlin at the start of the war or any of the big cities. But we were going to take a warning, which the warning was a bundle of leaflets. They put a chute in when we dropped them through the chute onto the city.
So what was the briefing like? Did you go to the briefing?
Oh, yes, I had to go to the briefing.
What was the briefing like? Can you take us through it?
Yeah, well, they told us, well, that's what I said. They said, we're just going there. We're not going to do anything dangerous. We're not going to do any bombing. All we're going to do is warn the German people about the civilians.
Well, what I mean is, did they tell you sort of what course you'd fly?
Like, oh, no, that's all. That was all for the aircraft, the actual crews themselves.
So there's a you had a briefing. What about the takeoff? Do you remember the takeoff? what would happen on the takeoff?
Well, you'd have to go. You wait for these flares because I was always in. I was in the back, so I couldn't see much. You wait for the flare, and up, they just go really go fast, and up you go. But one thing I must tell you about those instruments, I was meant to tell you before. On all aircraft, even today, they have magnetos and dynamos to operate the sparking plugs. Now, if you couldn't get the right rev counters on those, amount of revs on those, then you had to change the brushes on the dynamos, and that was part of my job as well.
I'll come back to that. Yeah.
But the last thing before takeoff, if the pilot says that's not working, we couldn't go, so I'll have to get out and change the brushes on the dynamo.
And was that a difficult job?
Well, yes. By the time you're undone, have you done all the things, all the clamps on the engine covers, and got those off? Get to it. It's quite hard to get to, and you had to get something to stand on because they're high up in the air. So it used to delay the flight for about an hour.
So you took off, and then what was it like? What would you be wearing? What was flying?
Oh, they called it a Sidcot suit in those days. It was a one-piece suit. It was supposed to be heated, but never worked properly. You had a wire that plugged in because the heating was in the air, quite didn't really work. It was freezing cold in the back of those things, absolutely freezing.
What would you wear under the Sidcot? I mean, would you have any?
Oh, a big thick pullover, a ordinary RF, not a full uniform, but RF trousers and that sort of thing, and a shirt, yeah.
Any gloves?
Yeah, oh yes, gloves, yeah.
Just one pair or
one pair of gloves, yeah.
And what about on your head?
Oh yeah, well you had a helmet with a radio in, which didn't work most of the time. Because they were in their early days of those, they weren't used to it in that time. Later on, obviously, it got a lot better, but it wasn't working very well.
Would that have your oxygen in it as well?
Yeah, so an oxygen mask built into that.
And what was it like breathing oxygen through that? I mean,
well, it's quite uncomfortable at first, but you only had to use it above a certain height, so they used to try and keep it below that height if possible.
So below 15,000,
yeah.
Now, what would you be doing when you're flying out? Say the first one, you're on your way to Berlin. I don't suppose you know the date, do you?
No, I've got no idea.
September-ish?
About that, yes.
You don't really know that, but what would you do? You're sat there in the back, freezing cold.
Freezing cold, trying to keep warm, that's all. Thinking, why did I do this?
Would you have to look at, I mean, how bad was the cold?
It was very cold.
I mean, how did you feel?
Very, very cold.
I mean, was it cold enough to sort of start making it so you couldn't use your fingers?
Oh, no, it wasn't that bad. The clothing was quite good.
You were cold.
You were cold. All aircraft was cold then. They hadn't got any real heating in them.
It was supposed to be worse for the rear gunner, though. So.
Oh, well, it was, yeah, because it couldn't be draft-proof, could it? Because especially with the engines for the guns, so the water. And the bloke at the front was the same. He had the same thing, same problem.
Now, this is very early days. Did you have any idea that there might be German night fighters? Or
no.
Was it a daytime raid, by the way?
No, nighttime.
Nighttime. I mean, were you looking for fighters all the way out?
Yeah, we were told us to keep our eye open, but we didn't know what we were looking for, to be perfectly honest. We hadn't seen any German fighters over that area at all. I don't think they bothered very much, the Germans, in those days, because we weren't bombing.
So it wasn't that It wasn't as pressurised as it would be later on.
Oh, no, way near, no.
So did you ever see anything? Did you ever see anything like that?
No, not very much.
No German aircraft?
No. Oh, by the way, I had some thick goggles on as well. That's another thing.
And what would happen? What do you remember of dropping the leaflets? I mean, you wouldn't see much from Rip, but I mean, could we...
Well, you had a chute built into the... And you used to drop them through the chute in big bundles.
Who would?
Well, the rest of the crew. The,
not you?
No, I couldn't get out the turret. The other gunners used to do... The mid-upper gunner and the other gunners used to do that. But they were in great big bundles, and they used to cheat sometimes and not undo them and drop them in one lump and hope it hit somebody in the head.
And, I mean, could you get out? Were you trapped in that? I mean, how were you meant to get out? I mean, could you get out of the rear turret?
You could get out by swinging the turret right round, but with 50 aircraft in flight, very awkward to get out of there. And you've got to unplug yourself from the heating up.
Were you aware that if the aircraft was shot down, you might have some problems?
Oh, yeah. Worry about that.
And you've not had any parachute training, I presume?
No, did never do. No.
But you did have a parachute?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Where was that? You wouldn't wear it, would you?
No, you're seating. It was a seating. You sat on it.
So if the aircraft was shot down, you'd have to get the parachute,
strap
turn
it up
the thing right around,
and get out,
unplug everything.
And then try and find the door.
So you were aware that was...
Oh, we knew that would happen, but there was no bother with that.
What about the flight back? Were you still watching for... Because that used to be when they...
In the early part, there was nobody to watch it. There weren't any aircraft about in those days, German aircraft. They were doing too busy doing the Battle of Britain business rather than...
It is September, probably.
Yes, yeah.
And what about Cologne was the other one?
Yeah.
Was that any different?
No, it was the same.
And when you got back, was there a debriefing for you or...
They asked if we've seen anything special. We couldn't tell them anything. We didn't know what we were looking for, to be honest.
Do you think if you'd seen anything, you could have made a reasonable fist at shooting it down? No,
I don't know. I really don't know. I never used the guns in flight at all. I did. You had to do it when you took off. You had to do a test fire, and that's all. It's first gun.
Had you any idea about deflection shooting?
No, none at all.
Did you know about it? Did you know you had to shoot a way ahead?
That's right, yeah.
You knew that?
Yeah. Part of the course they gave me in the afternoon was to take you clay pigeon shooting, so you could work that out. so you could work out deflection on that, you know.
Anything else about the flights out? Anything you remember? What about the crews? Did you get to know them at
all? Oh, yes, most of them. Oh, yes, they're all very friendly. There was none of this business of I'm an officer and you're a part so it was none of that business. We're all together always. The air crew were entirely different from anybody else.
But they were friendly.
Yeah.
Did they appreciate your work, do you think?
Oh, yeah, true, they did. They always come talk to you. Very, very, very good.